This is Being Catholic with Bob Johnston on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5.
Hi, this is Bob Johnston, and you're listening to Being Catholic right here on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5 FM and 92.5 FM in McLean County and Bloomington Normal, 88.3 up in Pontiac, and 97.1 in Lincoln. We're going to have a great show for you today. I'm here with my wife, Lynn. We've been talking about literature, what every Catholic should know, a book by Joseph Pierce, and we'll be talking about a little bit more of that today. We talked about some of the Romantic poets last week, and we will be talking a little bit about Dryden and also Coleridge today, and maybe finish up a little bit with the Romantics. But we're going to talk about a few other issues first. And I wanted to mention about the Halloween that we had. I hope everybody had a happy Halloween. It seemed more like sort of a happy St. Valentine's Day. It seemed like it was a February snowstorm. It could have been right out of February, the way that snow was blowing and coming down. And so I don't know how everybody else did. We didn't have very many trick-or-treaters. We do have a lot of candy left over, and I bet you a lot of other people do. Usually, Lynn, we talked a little bit about Halloween, and we really just didn't get into that last week. We were doing the literature. And I don't think we'll be probably having time to get into it this week, but I sort of missed it a little bit. We'll have to talk about some of those kind of issues again when we finish with this. I know you had something that you wanted to talk a little bit about before we start. So I'm going to turn that over to you, and maybe we'll talk about a few issues first here, and then we'll go into the literature again.
I first of all must clarify what I have to say is my opinion, nobody else's. But we talk about paganism creeping into society and so forth, and the blame the Catholic Church gets sometimes about the celebration of Halloween, and that shouldn't be anymore, so on and so forth. Lo and behold, what has happened the last 3 weeks over in Rome? The Amazon Synod. Why it wasn't held in the Amazon, God only knows that, but it was held in Rome. And to sum it all up, after seeing this Pachamani, it's an idol, an Amazon idol to the fertility of the earth. And seeing it displayed over there, the Pope being present, and the circle of people, if you watch it, to me it's adoration. An adoration that is not given to God. It is given to this mythical creature or being or whatever symbol. And it really upset me. And I went back and it brought to mind in the second book or second chapter of Maccabees 2, chapter 2, it says, "Alas, why was I born to see this, the ruin of my people, the ruin of the holy city, and to dwell there when it was given over to the enemy?" This came back in my mind, and it almost overwhelmed me to watch what was going on there. And then when people who rejected it and didn't approve and thought it was a pagan symbol got the Pachamama, figures and threw them into the Tiber, the Pope apologized, and he was saying, at first was saying that it was not meant to be for idol worship, that that was not their intent. They had put these figures into a church, St. Maria's, I can't remember the full name, a Carmelite church, and the Carmelites, I guess, got upset about it too. But when they had a little ceremony inside the church in near the sacristy and went through this, whatever you want to call it, this ritual, some of the pews were, many of the pews were turned with the backs of the pews to the
backs presence. Were to the altar.
Yeah, back and set it up in front of the altar, but in back of the altar, the people sat with their backs to the presence, the real presence of God. It just has really upset me. And I don't know if there's many of you out there that it's taken offense by it, but there you have it. I was very offended. And this came to my mind, how I think Bishop Schneider.
Athanasius Schneider, yes.
Athanasius Schneider, he said, it's like Moses coming down from the mount and seeing the worship of the golden calf. I just don't know what they're thinking of.
Well, I think, are you finished or do you want to go on?
Could go on for days, but okay. Go ahead.
Okay. I think, to be fair to some of these people there, in their minds, I think they're being bullied and buffaloed by the fact that we have sort of a fear of our past because Western civilization was technologically superior to a lot of these other civilizations. The West went in and did many things in various native cultures here in America and in other places that were wrong. They also did many, many things that were also good. And the fact is that the Catholic Church itself and most of the clergy, most, maybe not all, but most, never did these things. In fact, if anything, it was the Catholic Church that stood up for indigenous peoples and tried to protect them from the ravages sometimes of the superior technology of Western civilization and the settlement and so forth of their lands that was often unfair. And so we have been buffaloed in modern times, I think, into being so fearful of that past that we are going to be called, acting superior or acting condescending or not taking into consideration the intentions and, the understandings and religions of the natives. I think that we often are buffaloed into doing things and then trying to pretend that somehow we're being tolerant and all-encompassing. And I think maybe that's what happened here, and it got carried away into something that it never should have been, and then it turned into this debacle in which these idols, which they were thrown into the Tiber River, and then, of course, the Pope understands that much of the world might look at that as some kind of a act of desecration against these natives, and so he tries to apologize for that. The whole thing could be avoided if the Church, I think, and especially the Catholic Church, would simply stick to its traditions and its teachings and do those in a positive way and understand that it's not the right thing to do to bring these into a Catholic Church and especially to get buffaloed into a position where everybody is afraid to oppose it because they're going to look bad. And I think maybe that's what happened. What do you think about that, Lynn?
I think you're right, you are right, but I just get emotional about it. It seems like, we've lived through Vatican II, and the changes there were very hard for me to adapt to. And I get over that, get settled in, and then it's one thing after another. And I think this was the frosting on the cake where I thought it just really totally disillusioned me.
Well, there is a downside to all of this, too. The fact is I think in this synod, the so-called Amazonian synod that was held in Rome, rather, you would think it would be held in Brazil, where most of the Amazon is, rather than in Rome, I think that there are a lot of people, who call themselves progressive in the Catholic Church, and they want to change things, and they try to do it, a lot of it, in the what I would call the, leftist liberal way, by deceit, are using a lot of this worry and fear about stepping on the toes of indigenous peoples in order to advance their own cause. In other words, they're using these people to advance their own cause, which is to change the basics and sometimes, the dogmas of the Catholic Church. That is to introduce women into being receiving holy orders in the Catholic Church, being ordained deaconesses, and then later on, of course, this would lead to being ordained priests and that kind of thing. And the Germans that are there have a shortage of priests, are using it to advance the idea of married priests because they think maybe that'll bring more priests into the ranks so that they can that they won't have the shortage. And so I think that this is another thing that's happening, and that is, in effect, really it will come back to haunt these people and haunt the church by using other peoples to advance your own cause. And it seems like there has been a whole history of this among what I'm going to just say the left. That is, you know, this idea of this liberal advancement of pretending that you're doing one thing when you're really doing another and advancing your own cause in the name of doing something else. So I think a lot of that is in there too. And other people that may want to oppose it sort of go along with it because they don't want to look bad in the public eye. They don't want to look as if somehow they are stepping on the religion of these native peoples. And it became a debacle and a mess. And the whole thing is that somebody in planning this whole thing should have been able to see that it was ripe for these kind of things to happen, and it should have never been done this way. That's my opinion.
It's a good one. I just want to thank everybody for putting up with my venting this morning. And I just had it. It's been pinned up too long for the last 3 weeks. So thank you for listening to my vent. And I did want to give a little support to St. Francis of Assisi, not that he really needs it, but I hear this being brought up that St. Francis talked, you know, had a poem, the Cantle, to this brother, son, and so forth. What he was saying, Lord, thank you for brother, sun, and moon, and the earth, and all these glorious things you have given us that reflects your glory. He's thanking God. He's not worshiping the sea, the sun, the moon, and the earth, which they seem to be doing in the Amazon Synod. That's the last I'm going to say about it.
Well, I think you're right along that respect. The fact is that it's very clear that St. Francis is asking, you know, is thanking God for the gift of all the worldly things, for the gift of the creation.
Right.
And if one thing we can learn sometimes from indigenous peoples to some of these areas such as, the Amazon and so forth, is they still retain an awe and respect for the world around them, the nature and so forth, that maybe sometimes our higher civilization has lost. And that's a good thing. It's a good thing to understand and respect, you know, the earth and nature and all of the things. Those are givens that were given to us, and we're here as stewards to protect those things. And so sometimes, a people living a more natural and simpler life than we live can bring that understanding back to us again, and we certainly should be grateful for it. But the point is that these people are doing a good thing. They're no different than John. Remember in Revelation, John goes up to heaven and, you know, an angel appears, and John immediately gets down and begins worshiping the angel. I mean, after all, what would you do? This huge ball of light instills awe and fear, and the angel has to tell him, don't worship me. Don't do that. I'm a creature like you are.
Yeah, I was created.
But John was pointing himself in the right direction. And I think these native peoples in the Amazon and in other places, they're also pointed in the right direction. It shows that we all have a common humanity, and part of that humanity is being religious and searching for God. And this would have been a great time to take that and use it in a positive way by preaching the gospel and showing that there is a God that transcends nature, that actually the things that you're worshiping have been made by that God, and that while those things are beautiful, it is God himself who is to be worshipped. What a chance to have a great learning experience for both sides. And I think Western civilization has become ashamed of the fact that it does have some things, and in fact many things, that are an advancement and a good thing over the rest of the world. But just because you can use good things in a bad way, and they have been used that way sometimes in the past, doesn't mean that you should abandon them. And so we should be proud of our Christianity, because we have to get back again, I think, sometime, Lynn, and have a show again in which we talk about the what were called the Black Robes when this country was being settled. That is the Catholic priests who came here. And many of them worked, you know, with the Indians, taught the Indians, and did everything they could to protect the Indians from the ravages of Western civilization, you know, misused by people who simply wanted to, you know, take advantage of Native for their own greed. And so the Catholic Church has nothing to be ashamed of along these lines. If there were some abuses by a few priests here and there, or a few clergy or prelates or a few Catholics here and there, by and large, the Catholic attitude and behavior toward indigenous peoples was good. In fact, it was Catholicism that brought the whole idea of international law and everything else. These things need to be talked about. And maybe we can have a guest sometime. I have a person in mind, and maybe we'll see if that person can come and talk about some of these early prelates and priests and so forth who came and worked in this country with the peoples here in Illinois and in other places. So that would be a good show for the future, wouldn't it?
Oh, it certainly would. I look forward to that. I think maybe this whole thing with the Synod had the best of intentions, hopefully. I pray that that's what it was. But it sure has visually presented a different story.
Well, maybe we can take it and pull something out of it and turn it around to something that could be a good, useful lesson. Because the fact is that we shouldn't be using other peoples, and we shouldn't be withholding the truth from them either. That can be a boon. And, you know, the fact is that the Catholic religion is a huge gift that can be given to people, but it has to be given properly, and it has to be given as it really is in all of its traditional glory. And these people probably would be extremely interested in all of that if it was presented in the proper way.
Right. Even Athanasius Schneider said that. He spent 7 years? Seven? Yeah.
He spent a long time in the Amazon.
Oh, in the Amazon area. And mm-hmm. he said to the effect what you had just said. So.
Exactly.
That, you know, we don't have to use people as the team. I just need to drop it.
Yeah, and these people need to be aware of how much damage they can do to the people, who apologists and so forth, who do a great job of explaining Catholicism not only to people in the Amazon, but to people right here at home that don't understand it. And then something like this wipes it all out, because right. There are a lot of Protestants who will say, see, we told you the Catholics are that way, that yeah. they worship the earth and so forth, and that they've adopted all kinds of paganism, which is certainly not at all true, but it certainly made it look that way.
Well, so. This afternoon, I'm going to take a ride in the car and go out in nature, look at the animals and the deer and the changing of the season, and enjoy it.
At any rate, we've used up this first portion here, our first section on this.
But I think
I think it was worth it to talk about that issue. So we're going to stop here and take a break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You've been listening to Being Catholic with Bob Johnston on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5.
G.K. Chesterton wrote, "We do not want a church that will move with the world. We want a church that will move the world." Indeed, it was the Holy, Catholic, and Apostolic Church that built Western civilization. Discover the sublime beauty, transcendence, and silence of the ancient liturgy that formed so many of our great saints. To connect with the Latin Mass community of Bloomington Normal, visit latinmassblono.org. That's Latin Mass, BLONO.org.
Can you smell the turkey roasting? It's time for the annual Thanksgiving dinner at St. Mary's Parish Hall in Pontiac, November 10th, 11 until 2. The menu includes a complete turkey dinner and dessert. $10 for adults, $5 for school kids, or get a family deal for only $30. Carryouts are available. The St. Mary Woman's Guild of Pontiac invites you to Thanksgiving dinner on November 10th, 11 until 2. Oh, and be sure to stop by the Catholic Spirit Radio table.
Hi, this is Bob Johnson. We're back from our break. You're listening to Being Catholic right here on Catholic Spirit Radio. And we're going to go ahead and talk about Joseph Pierce's literature, What Every Catholic Should Know. We've been talking about it for the last several weeks. And last week we were talking about the Romantic poets, and we talked about Wordsworth and Coleridge. And we're also going to talk a little bit about some of the other Romantic poets I didn't get into. I mentioned that Wordsworth and Coleridge were the light Romantics, that is, Romantics that were seeing things more accurately and seeing nature as it, you know, the positive force that it could be. And they were actually moving more toward traditional Christianity, and they were moving a lot, especially Wordsworth, toward Catholicism, really. And we mentioned some of the others, Shelley and Byron and Blake. And these poets were poets who were what you might call dark Romantic poets, who moved away from this progression toward a more orderly, traditional look at and understanding of the world, and more to a rejection of rules, regulations, and civilized society. Probably understandable today with a lot of the movements that are going on, you know, in our Western society right now. And so we want to go ahead maybe and take a look at them. And when I mentioned earlier, I said we were going to also study, you know, Milton and Coleridge. I meant we're going to study Milton and Dryden. We're going to, you know, we already talked about Coleridge and Wordsworth. We're now going to talk a little bit about Shelley and about Byron, and perhaps a little bit touch on Keats, and we'll go from there. But at any rate, at the opposite of Wordsworth and Coleridge, Byron devoted a great deal of the preface to his long poem, Childe Harold's Pilgrimage. Child, in this case, meaning a knight. Didn't mean a child, C-H-I-L-D-E. It didn't mean a little child. It meant a knight. At any rate, in that work, he sort of attacked the monstrous mummeries of the Middle Ages. Mummeries here being a word for sort of like all the foolishness of the Middle Ages, the maybe sort of a idea of falsifications and so forth of the Middle Ages, when actually, in my opinion, the Middle Ages were a very, very civilized time, and much of our Western civilization and so forth was developed in forward in the Middle Ages. But there was a rejection, and still is a rejection of it, and a false one at that, in our society today, a false picture of it. And that false picture was promoted to a certain extent by people like Byron and Shelley in that respect. But at any rate, Shelley, in his defense of poetry, anathematized tradition by insisting that poets should be slaves or were slaves to the zeitgeist. And remember, we talked the zeitgeist is the world spirit as opposed to the Heiliggeist, which is the Holy Spirit, and that they were the mirrors of the gigantic shadows which futurity casts upon the present. Well, that all sounds, you know, very, very romantic, so to speak, and very important and profound, and it usually fades away and turns out not to be. And had these poets not died young, they probably would have started moving away from this kind of stuff. As it was, Shelley was getting a little bit tired of his own sort of attitude toward nature and rejection of civilization. And he was moving toward pantheism, which is a form of religion, at least, that can actually move, you know, later on toward Christianity. And Byron yearns for something more solid than the inarticulate creedless deum espoused in the Prayer of Nature that he wrote, and signs also that Shelley's militant atheism was softening into skylarking pantheism. And their early deaths and the early death of their fellow Keats has preserved them forever as icons of youth whose poetry often attained heights of beauty and perception which transcended the incoherence of their philosophy. Although, in my opinion, Keats's poetry, the actual poetry itself, not his philosophy, was a very fine form of poetry. And I think Keats certainly would have moved over toward religion and probably a more standard religion had he grown older. But the Byronic aura of the second generation of Romantics crossed the channel and metamorphosized into the decadence of Baudelaire, Verlaine, and Huysmans, all of whom plumbed the depths of despair before recoiling in horror into the arms of the Catholic Church. And that happens to a lot of young people. at first, you know, there's the wildness of youth, and they're going to reject all the tradition and go out and find in nature or somewhere else all of these wonderful things. And as they live and time goes on, it turns out that they're not so wonderful after all, and they themselves and the people around them are not so perfect after all either. So the symbolism of the French decadence recrossed the channel under the patronage of Oscar Wilde, who was an aficionado of both Baudelaire and Verlaine and Huysmans. From the publication of Lyrical Ballads in 1798 to the death of Oscar Wilde in 1900, Romanticism could be seen in large part to be a reaction against the rationalism of the Enlightenment. And I think we have a reaction today going against, you know, sort of the earlier 19th century materialism of the modern world. But I think a lot of the reaction is by people who think a lot of what happened back at that time was the fault of religion itself, so they're throwing out the baby with the bathwater. And we'll have to save that for another time to get into that. It was, however, schizophrenic, the Romantic movement. The light Romanticism of Wordsworth and Coleridge staggered falteringly in the direction of a revitalized Christianity. The dark Romanticism of Byron, Shelley, and Keats eventually to subjectivism, nihilism, and postmodernism. And sort of that's, you know, what it has morphed into today. And today we have this idea, I think, people in a sense rejecting, in a way, materialism, but becoming more and more materialist in doing so because they blamed the materialism on the faulty Christianity of the day and a lot of the faulty Christianity that's still going on right now. But at any rate, let us conclude by returning to our original questions. What is Romanticism? At its best, it is the generally healthy reaction of the heart to the hardness of the head. And that's good, but it can go too far. Is it right or wrong? It is often brilliantly right and sometimes disastrously wrong. Is it right or left? Well, sometimes it's neither, defying all efforts to be classified one way or another. Is it revolutionary or reactionary? It depends, of course, on how we are defining our terms. And if we examine what's going on today, some of it's revolutionary and some of it's simply reactionary. But if however, we are referring to political revolutions of the kind of 1789 and 1917, then it is counter-revolutionary and reactionary, at least in its English manifestation. What is it? It is at best an effort to rediscover what has been lost, a groping in the depths of experience and in the darkness of modernity for the light of truth that tradition preserves. And it's strange here that there is this it's turning back to what we've been talking about here in the Amazonian Synod, this idea of reconnecting with nature and reconnecting with the primitive people who grasp some of the awe and so forth of nature. But it's a misguided, you know, return. It's a shame that if these people would turn to the Christian religion that they've been given, the original, you know, Catholic religion, in all of its beauty, in all of its rationality, they would see that both Romanticism and rationality, that both the reason and also faith and emotion can be united together in a unified and a very, very beautiful way. And that's what the world is missing. And because I think that Western civilization anymore is so afraid of its past and so afraid of its supposedly, you know, bad reactions or, you know, bad treatment of indigenous peoples, that it is rejecting all the good that it has brought with it. And it needs to rediscover that. So we'll stop there on that one. And I want to talk a little bit now, and we're sort of going back. We went and skipped ahead to the Romantics for various reasons last week. And now we're going to go back, and we're going to talk about the Dryden, and we're going to talk about Milton, and we're going to talk about the differences between the two, and how Dryden moved more toward that rational, you know, Catholicism that we need to get back to, and there are great examples of it. And the idea of what we need to rediscover is the unity of Christianity. We don't need all of these different denominations that we have today working and counteracting against each other and against Catholicism. And it is a shame, again, that we had this ludicrous example of the Amazonian Synod making it look as if the Catholic Church believes or puts a stamp of approval on anything pagan, because it will undo a lot of the apologetics movement that has been going on, especially within EWTN, to show that Catholicism is the fullness of Christianity and is anything but pagan. You know, there is no paganism in it at all. It is the religion that converted many, many pagans over to, you know, to Christianity. And most of the time did so in a proper way. And yet, because some of those things went wrong, and especially went wrong, not so much with Catholicism, but with many of the Protestant denominations and so forth that acted in many of the primitive areas of the world, including the United States, before it was settled, that Christianity has gotten a bad name, and we have Catholics themselves bending over backwards to try and appear not, you know, to be have this condescending or superior attitude, and in doing so, they're actually abandoning or at least distorting their own faith. And so it undoes a lot of hard work by missionaries and a lot of hard work by Catholic apologetics, and it's a shame that it had to happen. So at any rate, with that in mind, let's plunge into Milton and Dryden and see what we can make of that. Is there anything you want to comment on before we start, Lynn?
No, go ahead. Go ahead. You don't want me to get on a rant again, do you?
Well, I think you had something to say, and I think it was a good idea to bring it in.
Okay.
But at any rate, Milton and Dryden, two literary giants, straddled the latter half of the 17th century. John Milton in 1608 to 74, and John Dryden, 1631 to 1700. It is to these giants that we shall now turn our attention. Although almost all of the great writers prior to the mid-17th century had been Catholic in either sympathy or practice, John Milton took up the Protestant cause with revolutionary zeal. And might be pointed out here, Milton, you know, was a Puritan, a Protestant Puritan. Following the victory of Cromwell's Puritan army in the English Civil War, he supported and defended the execution of King Charles I. And that really set a precedent to executing a king that has sort of come down through, you know, the halls of history all the way to this day. And was not really a very good thing to do. And I've talked about that before. Maybe we can, you know, talk about it again. But at any rate, he was in the middle of writing Paradise Lost at the time of the restoration of the monarchy, which he strongly opposed. Milton became so heterodox, denying the Trinity and the true divinity of Christ, that it is arguable that he cannot justifiably be called a Protestant or even a Christian of any sort, in the true sense of the word. And yet Paradise Lost is indubitably one of the true masterpieces of world literature, following in the noble epic tradition of Homer and Virgil. And it is. It's extremely well written. Very, very interesting, and as we'll see, it makes Satan actually the main subject of Milton. As such, it should be read and enjoyed and appreciated by Catholics. Nonetheless, Catholic readers of Milton's epic need to be aware of the heterodoxy that animates it. This heterodoxy still will be our focus. Therefore, even though such a critique should not blind us to the glorious sweep of Milton's use of English, the English language, or his gifts as a storyteller, or his wonderful depiction of marital love in the prelapsarian garden. At the dark heart of Paradise Lost is the looming and alluring presence of Milton's Satan, whose powerfully portrayed characterization has elicited sympathy from many readers of the poem, from Percy Shelley's eulogizing of him in the early 19th century to modern manifestations of sympathy for him in our own time. With respect to the latter, Edward Simon, in an article for The Atlantic on March 16, 2017, tries to get to grips with the fascination that Americans feel for the character of Lucifer in Milton's epic. In a well-written and well-reasoned article, Simon sees aspects of Milton's Satan in the characterization of thoroughly modern anti-heroes in the contemporary TV dramas, especially The Sopranos, Mad Men, and Breaking Bad, all of which are seen to reflect in some manner the American dream. This morbid fascination with Milton's archetypal anti-hero prompts Simon to ask a provocative question. What's so American about John Milton's Lucifer? And that's a question, you know, if you read Paradise Lost or read Milton, to answer is, what is so fascinating about Milton's Lucifer, to Americans especially? I think a lot of the answers, it could be one, Lucifer's autonomy, you know, his rebelliousness, his unwilling to obey, his idea that he's going to take his own stance and be his own person. And don't we have so much of that in America? I did it my way, even though it might work out to a disaster. Somehow there's something in America that, you know, I did it my way is sort of exalted. There's the antinomianism, that is the anti-rules and anti-religion aspect of Lucifer. He's going to reject all the house rules and play by his own rules. And don't we have a lot of that running through Americanism? And a lot of it gets, I mean, we may look at that in the movies and so forth and think that, wow, isn't that, you know, a unique character in all of this when we see movie heroes that are this way. But if that starts happening too much in real life, yeah, we soon grow very, very quickly tired of it because it destroys the very fabric of society. But at any rate, there is, however, another provocative question that must be asked if we are to avoid misunderstanding and misconstruing Milton's Satan. Regardless of how American he is, we need to ask how Christian he is. And we'll come back and we'll talk about that in the next session, so stay with us. We'll be right back.
You've been listening to Being Catholic with Bob Johnston on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5.
Can you smell the turkey roasting? It's time for the annual Thanksgiving dinner at St. Mary's Parish Hall in Pontiac, November 10th, 11 until 2. The menu includes a complete turkey dinner and dessert, $10 for adults, $5 for school kids, or get a family deal for only $30. Carryouts are available. The St. Mary Woman's Guild of Pontiac invites you to Thanksgiving dinner on November 10th, 11 until 2. Oh, and be sure to stop by the Catholic Spirit Radio table.
G.K. Chesterton wrote, "We do not want a church that will move with the world. We want a church that will move the world." Indeed, it was the Holy, Catholic, and Apostolic Church that built Western civilization. Discover the sublime beauty, transcendence, and silence of the ancient liturgy that formed so many of our great saints. To connect with the Latin Mass community of Bloomington Normal, visit latinmassblono.org. That's latinmassblono.org.
Hi, this is Bob Johnston. You're listening to Being Catholic right here on Catholic Spirit Radio. We're back from our break. We're talking about Milton and Dryden, and we're talking about Milton's Paradise Lost, and the hero of that work is actually Satan. I mean, there's no getting away from it. Milton Satan becomes a very identifiable person or character, and has a lot of attraction. And people who read Paradise Lost are fascinated with Milton. And so we have to ask the question, the most important question is not how American Satan is in this play, but how Christian is he? Does he really represent the Christian version of Satan? At the heart of such a question is a paradox. From an Orthodox Christian perspective, the real Satan is, at one and the same time, a Christian and an anti-Christian. He is a Christian in the sense that he knows that Christ is the incarnate Son of God. He is an anti-Christian because he hates the Son as he hates the Father. He knows the Trinitarian God and hates him. He is not an unbeliever. He is a rebel who is at war with the reality in which he has no choice but to believe. The demons in the gospel do not deny the authority of Christ. They defy him as far as they are able, and they despise him, but they do not and they cannot deny him. We see the same paradox in the manner in which Dracula in the old movies recoils in horror from the sight of a crucifix. He hates the symbol of the power of Christ, but he cannot help but retreat from it because the power he despises is real. The problem with Milton's Lucifer is that he is not synonymous with the Lucifer of the Bible or the Lucifer of Christian tradition. He is a figment of Milton's heterodox imagination. Milton's God is not the Trinitarian God of the Christians, but a Unitarian God whose Son is a mere creature, albeit the greatest of all creatures. Considering Milton's theological break with orthodoxy, his denial of the Trinity, and in consequence his denial of the Incarnation also, it is grievous erroneous to see Paradise Lost as a Christian work. Except for its biblical trappings, it is no more Christian in the orthodox sense than the earlier epics of Homer and Virgil, and arguably it is less so. It might be argued, for instance, as we have done, that Homer and Virgil were groping in the right direction toward the light of the gospel, whereas Milton, rejecting the church and the traditions of Christendom, was groping in the wrong direction, away from the light of the gospel. William Blake might have been right about what he said of Milton, that he was of the devil's party without knowing it. Certainly Milton was doing the real devil a service in inventing a mythical devil who has proved to be so attractive. Milton's Lucifer has what he perceives to be a just grievance and rebels against the perceived injustice with great courage. By way of contrast, it is hard to feel much sympathy with Milton's God, who is not loved because he is not lovable. He is an omnipotent Puritan prig who is right because of his might. A Pharisee himself, he might have well been the sort of God whom the Pharisees worshipped, but he has little in common with the God of the Christians. And sometimes I want to get back to, you know, what we were talking about with primitive peoples. Sometimes that's how Christians came on to primitive peoples. They invoked a priggish, superior God and used it as an excuse to take advantage of people who were technically not as advanced as themselves. And so I think that's what we are still reacting against and why sometimes we are afraid to present Christianity as something that's superior to what a lot of these indigenous peoples have, because we're afraid that we're going to be perceived as doing the same thing. We need to get over that fear. Meanwhile, Milton's Son is not worshipped because he is not God. In marked contrast to the biblical Jesus, he is depicted by Milton as a warrior who boasts of his martial prowess. Perhaps nobody in history has done more to evoke sympathy for the devil than John Milton, even though we may presume that he himself would have been appalled at this dark side of his legacy. In answer to the original provocative question, Milton's Lucifer is not Christian. He is no more Christian than the poet who gave him life. In consequence, those who feel that they have sympathy for the Miltonian devil are not sympathizing with the real Satan any more than they are rebelling against the real Christ. Having no doubt stirred up a good deal of controversy and having broken ranks with those many champions of Milton, such as C.S. Lewis, in highlighting the poet's heterodoxy over his indubitable genius, we will move on hastily to less contentious territory. The other literary giant of the latter half of the 17th century whom Catholics should know is John Dryden, whose greatest work, The Hind and the Panther, published in 1687, 2 years after his conversion to Catholicism, is a monumental apologia for the Catholic faith and an equally monumental rebuttal of the claims of Anglicanism. Like Crashaw, Dryden is a true colossus whose neglect by the modern world is scandalous. He deserves, like Crashaw, to become much better known. Like so many of his contemporaries, Dryden was buffeted by the religious conflicts that plagued the 17th century. His family had been staunch parliamentarians during the English Civil War, and his cousin, Sir Gilbert Pickering, was Cromwell's chamberlain, a fact which worked to the young Dryden's advantage when he came to London in 1657. His heroic stanzas on Cromwell's death in 1658 marked the beginning of his literary career. Having begun with Puritan sympathies, Dryden modified his religious position over the years. His didactic poem, Religio Laici, published in 1862, argued the case for Anglicanism. His finest poem, The Hind and the Panther, published 5 years later, heralded his conversion to Catholicism. So you can see this among both Wordsworth and Coleridge and here in Dryden, this movement toward Catholicism, this movement for wanting more, this movement for wanting coherence, this movement for wanting both faith and reason, this movement for wanting to better understand the world. And we as Catholics have that to offer, and that's what we should be offering in this Amazonian Synod, not some kind of syncretism trying to merge the two religions when they can't possibly merge paganism and Catholicism. At any rate, since his conversion coincided with the ascension to the throne of the avowedly Catholic James II, many people have suspected that he had cynical and self-serving motives in converting at this time. But the fact that he did not revert to the established church when the Protestant William III usurped the throne in 1688 suggests otherwise. Certainly The Hind and the Panther, which is the one poem by Dryden that every Catholic should know, bears the hallmarks of a genuine apologia for the Catholic faith and for the poet's embrace of it. It is a formal allegory in which the hind, a personification of the Catholic Church, is in dialogue with the panther, a personification of the Anglican Church. Divided into three parts, the first part deals with the various religious denominations in contemporary England, the most eminent of which is the hind, described as milk-white, immortal, and unchanged. And exactly, you know, that describes the Catholic Church, especially the Catholic Church should be immortal and it should be unchanged. I mean, this toying around with the idea of changing Catholic dogma can lead to nothing but disaster. The second part tackles contentious doctrinal issues associated with church authority and the dogma of transubstantiation. The final part calls for an alliance between the crown, the Anglican Church, and the Catholic Church to counter the rise of the various Protestant sects. And I've talked about that before, that there has to be, when Christianity was divided up by the Reformation into all these various sects, it has been watered down in the conquest of the American West and the conquest of I shouldn't just say the American West, but in the conquest of the Americas and the New World and so forth, much of Christianity was misused by people, you know, proclaiming or at least somewhat brought up in the Protestant tradition. It was misused to put down native peoples, and because of that, it got a bad name. Now, I'm certainly not tarring all Protestants with that brush, because there were many Protestants also themselves who protested against the treatment of the Indians. But the fact is that it was very difficult for Christianity to act in a unified manner when you have so many different denominations all acting against each other and all acting against the Catholic Church. So we need to go back to Bishop Athanasius Schneider. And he said, you know, why is all of this happening? Why is there this acceptance of, this idea of somehow or another being able to merge in some way with paganism? Why is this all entering and happening now? And he said it is because of this modern idea, and especially in this country, that somehow or another we are entitled to believe as we wish, that we are entitled to have any religion that we wish, instead of having our conscience formed properly. And he pointed out, he said, there is one true religion, and that is the full and complete Christian religion, and that religion was first incorporated by what is called Catholicism. It was called Catholicism because that means universal. The universal Christian religion is the Catholic religion in its fullness. And if it is expressed sincerely and seriously in its fullness, it can win over the world. But when it's split up and diversified into all various arguing sects, it gets watered down, and then it becomes apologetic for what it's trying to do. It's often misused, and we have what it, you know, happened during a lot of the 19th century and what we're fearful that might happen again today. And so we have this merging with and syncretism, this meaning merging with, you know, native religions, that somehow or another we can all be one and we can all believe in different things but at the same time still be unified. This is all utter nonsense. It's not going to work, and it's not what the gospel teaches. But at any rate, although the hind and the panther was attacked venomously and vociferously for its Catholicism by contemporary critics, which is not surprising considering the very anti-Catholic times in which it was written, later generations of critics, including some truly great writers, lavished praise upon it. Among its admirers were Alexander Pope, and Alexander Pope himself was a Catholic, Samuel Johnson, Sir Walter Scott, and William Hazlitt. Even Lord Macaulay, who had no sympathy whatsoever for Dryden's Catholicism, described some of the passages in the poem as magnificent. Considering the praise bestowed upon the hind and the panther by some of the eminenti of English letters, we might hope that in healthier and happier times, this magnificent poem and the reputation of its equally magnificent author might rise from the ashes of neglect like a phoenix of faith, resurrected and born again within the hearts of new generations of civilized readers. So we're going to stop today with Dryden, and Milton and Dryden, and next week we can take up some of the feminine genius, Jane Austen, Mary Shelley, and the Bronte sisters. So we'll address some of that next week. But again, Milton and Dryden represent two very, very different opposites: the rise of the Puritanism and the rise of an entirely, especially by Milton, different look, you know, at God and Satan, and a split in, you know, the Christian tradition. And we have John Dryden, who started out like Milton, with the belief in the Anglican Church and belief in the Puritan cause that was going on at that time, and then his movement away from that and his movement toward the fullness of Christianity, which is the Catholic faith. And we still have a lot of that going on today. We certainly don't need what's happening with this Amazonian Synod to cause more dissension and trouble in the world. And we do have to understand that the Western civilization was built upon Christianity, and that Christianity was built upon the Catholic Church. And so when it is rejected and it is, you know, confused and confused with what happened with some of the native peoples, both in Africa, South America, and the United States, because of the split in Christianity or the misuse of Christianity, we have to understand that it can't be fixed by some kind of just indifference to, you know, totally indifferentism, that somehow all religions are equally the same. That isn't some, you know, the beauty of the whole Christian religion is a gift from God to us, and we have been commanded to go out and spread that word in a thoughtful and a very careful and understanding way, of course, in a loving way to other people. But it is not something to be watered down by pretending that it can be equated with everything else. And most native peoples don't want that in the first place. And there are, if we do that, we are going to continue to have this split among peoples and a misunderstanding of what religion and Christianity really is. And it will take a long time to recover from it, so that it's not something we should ever fall into. And as Catholics, it's our duty and our job to be proud of our religion and be willing to go out and spread that religion and stand sometimes by the consequences of critics who may criticize that religion, but not hide from it and not get into the kind of situation that was caused here with this Amazonian synod. So at any rate, I hope it's been sort of enlightening, this session here, and we will come back next week, and we will take up a little bit more of literature, what every Catholic should know, by talking about some of the feminine people in literature, and some of those people were Catholics, some of those people were moving toward Catholicism, some of those people were not Catholics, but we'll talk about that, and I think it'll be very interesting at that time. Is there anything else that you want to add, Lynn, before we close?
Joseph Pierce, he's really done a great work with this. We've covered this for at least a month,
yes,
and there's still more to go in 200-some pages. It's amazing.
You can read it quickly, but when you talk about it like we're doing here, the ideas are so profound, it takes a while, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. Another thing I would urge you to read, pick up your Bible and read Romans 1, verses 20 through 32. Also, 1 Maccabees, chapter 2, verses 7 through 12. And see what you think about what the Bible has to say and what's going on. Let's pray now.
Saint Michael, the Archangel, defend us in battle. Be our protection against the wickedness and snares of the devil. May God rebuke him, we humbly pray.
And do thou, Prince of the heavenly hosts, by the power of God, thrust into hell Satan and all evil spirits who wander through the world for the ruin of souls.
Amen. We'll see you next week. We'll talk about the women authors, and it should be an interesting show.
You've been listening to Being Catholic with Bob Johnston on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5. If you'd like to contact Bob, email bob@catholicspiritradio.com. Again, that's bob@catholicspiritradio.com. Catholic Spirit Radio relies on your support to bring programming like this and EWTN to Central Illinois 24 hours a day. Please help keep Catholic Spirit Radio on the air with your generous support. Donate online at catholicspiritradio.com or send a donation to Catholic Spirit Radio, 108 Boykins Place, Normal, Illinois, 61761. That's Catholic Spirit Radio, 108 Boykins Place, Normal, Illinois, 61761. Catholic Spirit Radio is a 501c3, and all donations are tax deductible. Thank you for your support of Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5.